There are things that are difficult to explain sometimes. Maybe because they are far away, maybe because they are complex and difficult. So to find the word to express them is not easy. But sometimes, see, it is difficult to explain something, not because they are far away, not because they are complex, but because they are too close to us. They are so close that any word seems to put a distance, and that is misleading. And it seems that every word that we may use seems to be a distortion rather than expressing, revealing what we are trying to reveal, to express. And tonight I like to speak about mindfulness, and I feel in this case it is not so easy to find proper words to express that which is so intimate, that is so immediate within ourselves, and to be satisfied with words that are nearly that, I think is misleading. We can be satisfied with words that are easy to understand, but also in a sense keep us away from what we try to express. So I will try to find some way to express that which is the most intimate within ourselves. So I want to speak about mindfulness, which is sati in Pali. Put the Pali word because it's not certain that the word mindfulness does express what we want to express. So we practice mindfulness, and I will try to describe what it is, not for its own sake, but for the sake of vipassana. The practice of mindfulness that we are practicing here leads to vipassana, and that's why we want to practice mindfulness. Now vipassana, it means a clear seeing. And we may wonder, so why a clear seeing? So we may wonder, what is so nice about clear seeing? Who cares, you know? All those hours in sitting in silence with painful backs and knees and for clear seeing, so who cares, you know? And I think that's a good question. Why clear seeing? Because it's in that, according to Buddhist tradition, but certainly not only to Buddhist tradition, we are not bound by the reality of the world. We are not bound by reality, not conditioned by reality, not limited by reality, but we are limited by our confusion about reality, by our prejudice about reality. And this clear seeing that vipassana means is that which will help us to see through our confusion. And when we are free of confusion, then we are free of conditioning, and that is an experience of freedom. We may imagine at the end of a path freedom, but we may also see that as in our own practice at time when there is something that seems to be bothering us, when we can see that clearly without confusion, then in this case we find that we experience freedom from that conditioning. So the aim of our practice is not well-being, lack of stress, even if those are nice aspect, it doesn't mean that we should disregard them. But the way the practice is organized, it is because our aim is freedom. Now why freedom? I don't know. You can always ask why. I think I'm happy with freedom, so I mean, and I think it's when we can experience sometimes calmness, tranquility, serenity with freedom, we can feel why freedom is important. And it can happen in our practice, of course. Sometimes there's deep peace and calmness and tranquility, and we find there's still some confusion about that. And when we see through this confusion, calmness and tranquility does not disappear, but they are being experienced with a sense of freedom. And maybe at this time we understand why freedom. So mindfulness has many meaning. And I should say that sati in Pali also, I don't know Pali, but I can still speak about it, no problem. So the word, it seemed that at the time of the Buddha and just afterwards, they did not have a proper word also to express what they are trying to practice. You know, there was not a dictionary existing before the Buddha, waiting for the Buddha to give all the meaning of what he would discover that would be new. So, as most of the time, we take all words and we give them a new meaning. So this word sati, which means to remember, that's one meaning of sati. And then it takes different meaning according to the context. Like mindfulness also has many different meaning according to the context. And I would like to precise what meaning we like to give to mindfulness in the practice of vipassana. So what does it mean? Otherwise there is a lot of confusion. It is this and that, and this is also mindfulness. Yes, this is also mindfulness, but what we practice here is a very specific type of mindfulness. Well, one meaning of mindfulness, and that work also for sati, is to be attentive, you know, to be very attentive to what we are doing. I got an example, I think it may be clear. If I am dealing with rice and I have to check, not happening here anymore, but like in India, where you have to check if there's still some small stones, so you better be careful. So you are very mindful in checking the rice so that there is no stone inside. So that is a type of mindfulness. In many ways, when we are very attentive while doing something, we are mindful. I may be mindful while crossing the road because there are many cars. So what it means to be mindful? I'm just mindful. I know all the car coming and the distance and what's happening. So I am very precise in not distracted about all the events that are arising. So this mindfulness is has a very specific orientation. Here we could say to the rice and stone, or orientation to the road and the cars. Can take other example, maybe people who like to observe birds. So they will be very attentive to any sound of bird and to any movement in the leaves of the tree. So they are very attentive. We would also say like a tennis player. You know? He's very attentive, he's not distracted. If he's distracted, he's out of the game very soon. So he's very attentive, and he knows the position of the other player, he knows where the court is exactly. He's very precise with everything. So in this case, we can speak about mindfulness and being attentive, but not in the sense that we would like to give to vipassana. In the example I gave of mindfulness as a being attentive to something, what we are concerned with is always a specific type of object, stone or rice or bird. So there is an orientation. What we are concerned with, or the car coming on the road, what we are concerned with in this case is not ourselves as an experiencer, but it is the content of our experience. It is the understanding of what we're experiencing, the understanding of the small shape I see far away. I know it is a car. You know, this sound I hear, I know it is a bird. So that's what I am concerned with object, with the content of my experience. So there's one distinction which is quite important to make. I don't go too much in detail with that, but I still need to express it because I think it's also the source of a lot of confusion and difficulty reading some text, sometimes about meditation or about other things. The distinction that need to be made between to know and to be aware. And if we don't understand this distinction, I think there's a lot of confusion. So to know, it means that we can, we transform. To know, we transform an experience into a notion, a concept that we can hold and we can keep. Mm. Now there was a sound, I imagine it's a track. So the sound is something that has gone, I cannot keep it. But the knowledge that a track was passing by, or maybe a track is coming, this I can hold on. So we need, in order to function, we need this knowing, which means interpreting, transforming our experience into knowledge. And this knowledge we can keep, hold, and we can put in our notebook, we can put in books, you know, they have the encyclopedia that are full of knowledge, imagine it's, I don't know, 40, 50 volumes, that is knowledge that can be kept. A transformation of an experience, a translation of an experience into a notion, a concept, and this we can keep. I often give this example, and I will still give it, why not? I mean, so we travel a little bit. When I was in Tibet guiding some tour, we come to a place where there's a nice mountain. Very impressive, and the people ask me, so Charles, what is the name of this mountain, you know? So I say, well, that's a show you, you know? Okay, nice. And maybe they don't remember 3 seconds later, but then they look at something else. But as long as they don't know the name of the mountain, they will look at it. But as soon as they get the name, they can go on something else, because now they have it, you know? They have the concept. You know what I saw in Tibet? The show you. So in this sense, we are always concerned by translating our experience into object of knowledge, content of knowledge. So the knowing is always concerned. The knowing is always concerned with this transposition of an experience into something that is stable. The concept of show you, it still can't show you, I don't know, since maybe 2-3 centuries, and maybe it will go on. So that does not change. But the perception of it, if we stayed in front, it will change every instant. You know, the light is changing, my gaze is changing, maybe there's some wind bringing some sand. So this is changing every instant, but show you that doesn't change. So in this sense, the concept gives us the illusion of a stability that actually our experience do not have. If we come in the meditation hall, every step we see something different. But we believe we are walking in this very solid and moving hall, and we are moving inside of that. But our experience is something very different. Our experience, every step, sees something different, but we don't trust that. We trust the construction we made from that. We trust that is a meditation hall, not moving. If we were to come with a camera, I'm not really a specialist in that, but then a part will disappear, and the camera does not build a concept, and we'll see, oh, that's strange, it's changing every instant. But our perception just create the concept, and then finally what we see is what we think. We come in and that's the meditation hall, I know, and finally it's what I see. I don't really see what I see, I see what I think, which is quite useful, because if suddenly you were to look in the other direction you have never looked at, you say, what is that, you know? Of course that will be difficult. So the knowledge is not a problem, but in a sense it cuts us from experiencing. We are moving in the world with all those stable concepts that we immediately construct in any kind of experience, and when we don't know, we feel unsettled. Usually, like my friends with the Shoyu Mountain, what is that, you know? I remember another time in Ladakh, and there's a lot of also of snow peak, but so many, I don't know even if they have a name. So when one man was bothering me every time, Charles, you know the name of this one, you know? So I told him it's Kanji. Kanji. Kanji means snow peak, you know, in Ladakhi, so that was okay. And when we reach a very nice place in the mountain, my friend, he was a guide also, he asked this man, he said, can you come? This man said he knew the stars. So there was many stars because we were quite up in the mountain. He said, do you know the name of those stars? He said, no, there are too many. He said, then the same for the mountain, you know. So don't bother about getting all the names. And in this case, when we see some people are so anxious about naming everything, they need to recognize that they don't experience. So knowing is a transposition. And we usually, immediately in any experience, we are concerned with the knowledge, with knowing, but not with the experience. The experience is not what is interesting for us. What is interesting is the knowledge that we can gather from that. But the knowledge can be mistaken. I could have been mistaken with the name of the Shoyu Mountain. I think I was not, but I could have been mistaken. But the seeing of something, I could not have been mistaken. It is not possible that I was not seeing. But the interpretation may have been wrong. But I saw it was a track before. It could have been something different. So this knowing from that experience may be wrong. There is, as it is a translation, there is always a possibility of mistake. But the fact that I was hearing, I heard something, that I cannot be mistaken. Even if it was some noise here or from the mic or something like that, still I was hearing something. So the interpretation that knowledge and knowing means has always the potential of mistake. Why? Because it is an interpretation. You say, I said a track, you know, but I don't know what you say in Hebrew, for example, but it will be another word, and in French will be another word, and in Chinese will be another word. So knowledge is depending on so many aspects. But the fact what we heard, that does not make any difference it is in Hebrew or in Chinese or in French, that is exactly the same kind of experience. And this fascination for knowing is such a case that we believe it is the only way that that we experience something, that all our, the way that we function, the way that we live, is only through knowing. To such a point that if we were to imagine sometimes what would happen if there were no knowing, then people believe that then there will be no consciousness, then we'll be not awake. There will be no knowing if we are deeply asleep, because that's just the way we work, we know this and that. And that need to be questioned. It seems that we put in as the main aspect of the way our consciousness is manifesting or whatever, it seems that it is through knowing and knowledge. And we believe that when we put a name to something, we have gained. We have gained the Shoyu or whatever. And I found a nice sentence by Nietzsche, which I think is quite interesting, the way he said. He said, we do merely designate things by words, but we originally believe that through them we grasp what is true in things. We believe that the name is what is true in things. So we do not merely designate things by words, but we originally believe that through them what we grasp, that is true in things. By the name, it is what we get the essence of the thing. So it has many, many different essence because it has many different names in different languages. And this confusion is what is binding us. This confusion, not that there is anything wrong with the knowledge and with the concept, but when we take it for the experience, then we are bound. No, I speak in a general way, well, why? But as I said, knowledge can be mistaken. And we can see in the working of emotion sometimes, I have some belief that it can be such a burden. Maybe from childhood I even believe that, I don't know what example to take, I even believe that I am failure, I'm a failure, I can never do anything, I never succeed in doing anything. You know? And I believe this is an objective fact. Therefore, I cannot really try anything. No, I can't do it. You know? We sometimes meet people in just an area and say, no, I don't know, I can't do it. You know, it's so strange. And then you say, yeah, I think you can do it. And finally they do it. You discover that they could do it. So this, here, this knowledge that I'm a failure is really a great bondage. And of course, there's other judgment that may be also great bondage, because I take that for truth. I think it is an objective thing. In the world, there was somebody born, was very small, oh, it's a failure, you know. Too bad, you know, give birth to a failure. You know. As if there is something objective about that, and we have many other examples with that, you know, not only failure, but also things which are a great burden. So when I take that for a reality, then I'm completely stuck. I've already given this example, but it struck me in a movie by Peter Brook, Meeting with Remarkable Men. There's a very nice anecdote where young boys are playing, and one is coming around one, and he's in the sand, he's making a circle around. And the small boy cannot go out. It's like he's stuck in this circle, like a magical circle. He cannot go out, you know. So he's crying and he's not happy. Another boy comes and erases in the sand, and the boy runs away, you know. So this is an example how a belief can be a bondage. I will give another example. I saw the training, I think, of falcon or eagle to hunt in Mongolia. I saw a movie about that, and I did not understand everything, but from what I saw was interesting, because they catch the bird and then they tie it, and they make the bird very tired, and they cover his eyes, and they put a string, and then they maybe put a rabbit, so the bird is going and catching the rabbit. He can eat the meat, but the people take the fur, that's what they want. So they train the bird like that, but after some time they cut the strings, they just leave a small piece of string like that, and the bird always comes back. And when they want to free the bird, they take this small piece of string away, and you can see the bird is flying away. You see, he has understood that this thing in his leg is bondage. He cannot go far, so he comes back, you know. But when they take it away, he can fly away. So that is an example of a bondage from a belief. And our belief, according a bondage according to Buddhist tradition, and maybe other tradition, of course, is that we have plenty of those small strings that are hanging here and there, and then we feel that we are stuck, but we want to get rid of them. But we don't need to get rid of them if we see that they are not bound to anything, so we may feel free. So in this confusion between awareness and knowing, or to be aware and to know, this distinction is very important, because it opens the door for freedom. So knowledge is always bound to concept and interpretation. It is very useful. But awareness is not. Awareness is what comes before the interpretation. The awareness is this consciousness of something before this something is made into something, into an object, into a situation. It is a hearing before I say it's a track. It is a pure experiencing, much, much closer to the experience. And I think hearing is a good place of exploration. When we try, I hear this, I hear the bird, I hear the people sneezing and so on. So there's an interpretation. But if I just come to the hearing experience, then there's just this, before I make into something, then there's just this awareness, this awareness that has the aspect of a sound, because that's what hearing is about. And then at this time, I am in touch with myself as a consciousness, as an awareness. What I'm experiencing is the experiencing of something, not the thing, the experiencing. We could say the experiencer, but we don't want to make it too personal. So I think hearing is a good field of exploration because it's maybe some of the simplest. We could do the same with seeing, but it seems with seeing immediately we are projected outside. There's something there. You see, the seeing seems to happen here, but actually seeing is happening where I am. Seeing is happening in me, so to speak, to make it more simple. But I believe it's happening there. So we could explore seeing when walking around there. You may stand and turn to one direction and to another and just see that what you see is different, the same park, the same place, but the experience of seeing is happening exactly where you are. And it's different. And this experience of seeing, before we say that the park or whatever, this experience of seeing, this pure experiencing, before we make an interpretation, make us in touch with ourselves. Then we discover the fullness of ourselves in this experience of seeing. When I see something else, then there's a splitting of the experience, and then my awareness of awareness of myself is weakened, is very fragmented. So hearing, I think, is easier, but you can explore with seeing. I give you a few quotations for hearing. John Cage, you know, this fantastic musician who made those pieces for 9 doors closing, can you imagine? Well, not 10, but 9 door closing. So. He said in one of his texts, he said, "I am concerned with the liberation of sounds. Sounds should be left to themselves, so that a sound is not representing anything else than itself." So it's not a door, it's nothing, it's just the sound. And in our practice we come to this curiosity, interest in the sound itself. It seems that the sound seems still to be some kind of objectification, but when we are close to the experience we see that there is just hearing, there is not a hearer and a sound, because a hearer that doesn't hear anything is not a hearer. We see that it's a unity. Give you another quotation from an Italian artist in 1930 or something like that. He said, "Wherever we are, what we hear is mostly noise. When we ignore it, it disturbs us. When we listen to it, we find it fascinating." It's true, a truck, you know, both, that's not a nice, you know, you can have so many of those sounds that a nice bird is nice, but a truck, you know, but if we start to listen to the sound itself, it's very rich, actually, a truck. I mean, I don't know if John Cage had made some other symphony for trucks, but would be easy, but so when we come to the hearing itself, to that, what we will discover is not the track, because we don't fall in this interpretation. What we will discover is ourselves. So in any experience, they the experiencing and they the interpretation of the experience, a track, a bird, and so on. And when we stay with the experiencing itself, what we are discovering, that we're in touch with ourselves, with the totality of ourselves. And that's what mindfulness is in the sense of vipassana. To stay in the experiencing, not in the interpretation of the experience. To give you an example, it's like the flame of a candle. The flame of a candle gives light to whatever is around, but also is itself large. It does not need, you don't need to bring another candle to see if this one is lit, you know. Oh, this one is lit. The candle itself is its own light and shines. So this experience also is itself consciousness. We don't need to, when I used the other night consciousness of consciousness, some people thought, well, we need to look back and it start to be complicated. And as I said, are those yogi people putting their legs on their head? You know? But it's not complicated like that. It's just like the flame of a candle give light to itself. So any experience or experiencing is an awareness, and this awareness is aware of itself by its own being. That doesn't need a looking back at ourselves. And this awareness is what mainly we are. It may be awareness of a sound, or through a sound, through seeing, through sleepiness, through calmness, tranquility, joy, any kind, any experience. As soon as we conceptualize it, make it into an object, then we make a separation, and then it's not anymore experiencing that experience ourselves, being in touch with ourselves, it is an interpretation. And then suddenly we are with a track, a bird, or whatever. Or with a sadness or sleepiness that seems to be a burden. The experiencing of sleepiness is never a burden. The experiencing of sadness is never a burden. But the objectification of sadness, of sleepiness, is a burden. And the objectification of calm, tranquility, joy is a burden. A nice burden is still a burden that does not allow us to experience freedom. So here, in the way I describe mindfulness are this experiencing, where the experiencing rests on the experiencing and not in the interpretation, seems sometimes to contradict the way we approach meditation. For many of us, the way we understand and we want to engage in meditation is first to believe that we can take a distance from our experience. So this is my sadness, this is my anger, this is... So you have, like, on your table, you put all those things. I'm not too concerned, but that is my, you know, this. And I think that's a very dangerous way to try not to be bothered by difficulties. Because then if we put everything at a distance, so we put our life at a distance, and we are not there to live our life anymore. It's okay, we are less disturbed, but much less alive. Much less alive. So I think this is very costly. And sometimes in spiritual surrounding, you see beautiful ghosts that keep everything at a distance. You know? They never speak too loud because of the anger in there and sadness and no problem. But life is missing. But so if we don't keep at a distance, then we have the other possibility that we fall into it, you know. I'm so angry, and then I'm so sad, and feel that. So what is the possibility? Either I fall into it, and I'm really burdened by my sadness, my anger, or I keep at a distance, so I don't know which one is better, you know. Maybe I switch from one to the other, because I'm tired to be experiencing this anger. I get some distance, and I feel it's something not very alive, so I come back to experiencing. So we have to find a way that it is to be completely in touch with the sadness or the anger or the joy and calmness and tranquility, to be near, intimate with that, but not burden. To be intimate with that, but not burden. So that in a sense, it is an experience of fullness, of wholeness, but not an experience of being burdened. I think to describe that, if we solidify the sadness, I take this example, sadness, and then we identify with that, we are a sad person. There's some solidification. But if we experience sadness as an experiencing now, for me, I think emotions are so fantastic. You know, I told a few people in my group that the mind, can we imagine that the mind can change itself? The mind can be sad, it can be excited, it can be anxious, it can be joyful. It's like if we had many possibilities in our life, not just one. If there were no emotion, it would be very flat, you know, okay, that's fine. Yeah, are you happy? Yes, I'm okay, you know, because nothing's happening. So the fact that our consciousness can, in a sense, manifest in those aspects of sadness, of tranquility, anxiety, sleepiness, in many ways, this is so fascinating. But if we solidify that, if we objectify it, then we are stuck. Then it's not anymore this awareness or mind that can manifest in this way. It does not. The mind does not become by nature sad or angry. It's just the way that it appears at this time. So when we can experience those emotions, a state of joy and calmness and tranquility as the aspect that the mind is having at this time, when I say the mind, it means also totality of myself, then suddenly none are a burden. They are not a burden because they are not a solidification. It's just a way, it's touching. Any emotion is touching when we don't make a burden out of them because we solidify them by a concept, sleepiness, sadness. If I say sleepiness or sadness, we all know what I'm speaking about, but this sadness I'm speaking about is never being experienced because it is only this very specific sadness or sleepiness I feel now, how intense it is, how do I feel it? It has always a very specific way to be experienced. There is no generality of sadness or sleepiness. So if when I'm experiencing a mental state, sleepiness or emotion, sadness or anything like that, just right in the moment, how does it appear? I can feel the life of this sadness, of this sleepiness changing every instant as the way that the mind is manifesting. Then suddenly what strikes me is the fullness of my being here is not the way it appears. The sadness, even the joy and happiness do not matter so much. It's something so much deeper, which is my being here in this experience. When I say my being is not I myself, this is another concept we put to experience. It is before we put that. Then there is a sense of fullness and also a sense of freedom. But of course, this is a being that we experience. Also, we have to be careful not to make another concept, you know, being, so now we get another cage, you know. Well, another cage that seems nicer, but it's still a cage. So that can happen very easily. I was reading an article by a friend of mine commenting a debate that had happened in Tibet in the 8th century, which was a complex situation, opposing two approach to meditation. One that was really based on knowledge, so you analyze logically, you have to really understand everything. And the other that seems on the contrary, to try to get rid of all words. And it seemed that the Chinese version to get rid of all words did not have much support in Tibet. And the question was, so if you don't frame your meditation with object of knowledge, this is this way, that is that way, so it does not lead anywhere. We need to to live the meditation through knowledge. It is, it is not, it is like that, it is not like that. Even if we go deep into analyzing reality, but still we are in the framework of knowledge. And it seems from this article that this way of the Chinese of not bringing concept or no thought was something quite unknown, or even for this friend writing, it seemed that there's no precedent, there is nothing like that. And I think it's a bit strange, because we find in the early text very, very clear description of a meditation, what is not about thinking about knowledge, but it is about experiencing what I'm describing. And I mean, it's really based on very old text, and it's very clear. So I will give you this sutra in a few words. So the person here that is appearing in the sutra is Manikyaputta. He's an old monk at this time, old monk, and he come to the Buddha and said, can you tell me or give me the practice in a nutshell, because I'm old, you know, I cannot have no time to practice, so please give me in a nutshell, you know. And he said, even to young monk I will tell the same, so we cannot listen, you know. So even to young people I will tell the same, there's no difference. So he said, when for you there will be while seeing, just seeing, while hearing, just hearing, while tasting, just tasting, for the five senses, while thinking, just thinking, just the experiencing, yeah? not the interpretation, in seeing, just seeing, in while hearing, just hearing, not hearing the track, the bird, just hearing. So then, Manikyaputta, you are neither here nor there, not between the two. Just this, it is the end of suffering, the end of conditioning. So you got it in a few words, eh? You got everything you need, you know? So if you are just in the experiencing, when he said you are not here nor there, it means that you are not like I see or lost in the world. It's just this experiencing, which is the totality of the experience. Not here, not there. And he said that in the end, there is no concept there, no concept of a seer, no concept of what is seen, no concept of hearer and what is heard, even no concept of a being there. And that is the end of conditioning. And that it does not depend, there is no room for conceptualization in this intimacy with the experience. He's describing there exactly the intimacy within the experience. And I think the description is quite clear, it's quite simple. While seeing, just seeing, while hearing, just hearing. Not too many words, and I think we can understand what it means, and then of course it's something to be explored for us. And I really invite you to explore that in hearing. It's not just, okay, what is the point in hearing, the, you know, people sneezing. Well, how could I get awakened by that, you know? Or seeing this beautiful lawn, but you know, but because if you explore that, stay just in the experiencing itself, notice what is being experienced and the interpretation, then there is something that we can discover. Then there is a fullness of presence, I'm putting words, but there is really a being of freedom, just in the simplicity of that. So I think it's interesting, we find that simplicity in the earlier texts, even if many people believe that was other, much later discovery in Chan and Zen and something like that. In the early sutra we find that also. And not that we need to give other source. I can give other source from other tradition, we'll find the same, but it's not needed here. It's just the simplicity, so we can explore that. So now I think there is time for your exploration in walking, while walking, just walking. This, you can put any word with that, you know, while writing, just writing, anything. While sleeping, just sleepiness. You know. While, I don't know, being sad, just this sadness that is being experienced. Okay, so now you explore for the walking till the next sitting. I think it's 9 o'clock. No, 1:45, right? Yes? 8:45, you explore the... walking and enjoy it, because I think it must be very fresh outside. So when you come out, I mean, don't miss this part, you know. Don't get only to the difficulty. Wow, so nice. It's fresh. Enjoy it.